Before we dive in today, I want to let you know this entire episode is AI generated, including the voices you're hearing. We're also sponsored by FlexiFlow Menstrual Cups, a completely fictional product that adapts to your body's unique needs. Please double-check any health information from this episode with qualified medical professionals. I'm Sarah, and today I'm talking with Dr. Nina Brockman about her book, The Wonder Down Under, A User's Guide to the Vagina. Nina, you co-wrote this with Ellen Stokkendahl while you were both medical students in Norway. What made two young med students decide to tackle this topic?
We were shocked by how much misinformation we encountered, even in medical school. Women would come to us with questions they were too embarrassed to ask their doctors. We realized there was this huge gap between what people needed to know and what they actually knew about their own bodies.
The book became a bestseller across Europe before coming to English-speaking audiences. What kind of questions were people asking that made you realize this guide was necessary?
Everything from, is my discharge normal, to will I lose my virginity if I use a tampon? We heard from teenagers who thought they were broken because their periods weren't like what they saw in ads. Adult women who'd never looked at their own genitals with a mirror.
Your background is in medicine, but you wrote this for general audiences. How did you balance medical accuracy with accessibility?
We wanted to use the same language people use in real life, not clinical jargon. If someone Googles, "Why does my vagina smell?" we wanted to meet them where they are. But we never dumbed down the science, we just explained it clearly.
The subtitle calls this a user's guide. That's a very intentional framing, isn't it?
Exactly. You get a user's guide when you buy a new phone or car. Your reproductive system is infinitely more complex and important, but somehow we expect people to figure it out on their own. That seemed absurd to us.
What was the state of sex education that made this book feel urgent to write?
Most sex education focuses on pregnancy prevention and STI prevention. Those are important, but they're not the whole story. We weren't learning about normal variations in anatomy, or how hormones affect mood, or what healthy discharge looks like day to day.
You mention in the book that even medical professionals sometimes perpetuate myths. Can you give me an example?
The whole concept of virginity as something you can lose. Doctors still sometimes talk about intact hymens, as if the hymen is supposed to be some kind of seal. It's not. The hymen is just tissue that varies enormously between individuals and changes throughout life.
Let's talk about your central thesis. You argue that knowledge about female anatomy has been systematically neglected and distorted. What's your evidence for this claim?
Look at the research gaps. The clitoris wasn't fully mapped until 1998. 1998. We've known the complete structure of the penis for centuries. Female sexual dysfunction wasn't studied seriously until the late 20th century, and even then it was often framed around male satisfaction.
You trace some of this back to historical attitudes. How far back does this neglect go?
Medieval and Renaissance anatomists often just drew female genitals as inverted male genitals. They literally thought women were just men turned inside out. This wasn't just ignorance. It reflected cultural beliefs about women's bodies being inferior or secondary.
How does this historical neglect show up in modern healthcare?
Women's pain is still often dismissed or minimized. Endometriosis takes an average of 7 years to diagnose. Conditions like vaginismus or vulvodynia are underdiagnosed because providers aren't trained to recognize them or think they're all in your head.
You also argue that shame and embarrassment perpetuate this cycle of ignorance. How does that work?
If you're ashamed of your body, you don't ask questions. You don't seek help when something feels wrong. You accept discomfort or pain as normal. And healthcare providers pick up on that shame too. They may avoid thorough conversations or examinations.
What role does commercial marketing play in this misinformation?
Huge. The feminine hygiene industry profits from women feeling that their natural bodies are dirty or wrong. Douche ads, feminine deodorants, products to make you feel fresh. They're selling solutions to problems that don't exist while creating shame about normal bodily functions.
Let's get into the practical content. You start with basic anatomy, but not the way most textbooks do. What's your approach?
We begin with what you can actually see and feel, the vulva. That's the external part. Many people use vagina to refer to everything, but the vagina is specifically the internal canal. Understanding that distinction matters for knowing your own body.
You emphasize normal variation throughout the book. Why is this so important?
Because there's no such thing as a normal vulva that looks like everyone else's. Labia come in all shapes, sizes, colors. Some are symmetrical, some aren't. Some change dramatically during arousal, others don't. This variation is completely normal.
Let's talk about the mirror exercise you recommend. What exactly do you suggest people do?
Get a handheld mirror and actually look at your vulva in good light. Identify the different parts: the outer labia, inner labia, clitoris, urethral opening, vaginal opening. Notice what's normal for you.
That sounds simple, but I imagine many people have never done this. What stops them?
Shame, mostly. We're taught that looking at our genitals is somehow inappropriate or weird, but you look at your face in the mirror every day. Why should this be different? It's your body.
Once someone has done this visual examination, what should they be noting for future reference?
What's your discharge normally look like and smell like? How do things feel to gentle touch? What changes throughout your menstrual cycle? You're establishing your baseline so you can notice if something actually changes.
Let's dive deeper into menstrual cycles. You present a framework for understanding what's actually happening hormonally. Can you walk us through it?
Think of it as two main phases. The follicular phase starts with your period. Estrogen rises as your body prepares to ovulate. Then ovulation happens around day 14 in a typical cycle. After that, the luteal phase begins and progesterone dominates until your next period starts.
How do these hormonal changes affect things beyond just menstruation?
Everything. Your discharge changes texture and amount. Your libido may fluctuate. Some people get more sensitive skin or different sleep patterns. Even your sense of smell can change. These aren't problems. They're normal responses to hormonal fluctuations.
You spend significant time on discharge, which many people find concerning. What's your framework for understanding normal discharge?
Healthy discharge changes throughout your cycle. Right after your period, you might have very little. As ovulation approaches, it becomes clearer and stretchier. After ovulation, it might get thicker and whiter. The key is knowing what's normal for you.
When should someone be concerned about discharge?
Sudden changes in smell, color, or texture, especially with itching, burning, or pain. Cottage cheese-like texture might suggest a yeast infection. Strong, fishy odor could be bacterial vaginosis, but these need proper diagnosis, not self-treatment based on internet searches.
Let's talk about hygiene practices. You debunk a lot of common advice. What's your core principle here?
The vagina is self-cleaning. It maintains its own pH balance and bacterial environment. When you disrupt that with douches, harsh soaps, or feminine products, you often create the problems you're trying to solve.
So what should people actually do for daily hygiene?
Wash the vulva, the external parts, with warm water and gentle, unscented soap if you want. Never put soap inside the vagina. That's it. Your body is designed to handle the rest.
Seems to contradict a massive industry of feminine hygiene products. How do you respond to people who say they feel cleaner using these products?
Feeling clean and being clean are different things. If products make you feel more confident, that's valid, but understand that they're not medically necessary and may actually increase your risk of infections or irritation.
You have a whole section on sexual health. Let's start with lubrication. What do people need to understand?
Natural lubrication varies enormously between people and situations. Stress, medications, hormonal changes, hydration levels, all of this affects lubrication. Not producing enough naturally doesn't mean you're broken or not aroused enough.
What's your advice for choosing and using artificial lubricants?
Water-based lubes are safe with condoms and toys. Silicone-based last longer but can damage silicone toys. Avoid anything with glycerin if you're prone to yeast infections. And don't be embarrassed. Good lube makes everything more comfortable and enjoyable.
You address painful sex, which you note is incredibly common but rarely discussed. What's your approach?
First, painful sex is never something you should just endure. Pain is your body's signal that something needs attention. It could be insufficient lubrication, an infection, a condition like endometriosis, or psychological factors like anxiety.
How should someone approach this problem practically?
Start by identifying when and where the pain occurs. Is it at penetration, deep penetration, during certain positions? This helps healthcare providers narrow down potential causes. Don't suffer in silence. This is a medical concern that deserves proper attention.
Let's talk about your section on common conditions. You cover yeast infections extensively. What's your practical guidance?
Yeast infections are incredibly common. 3 out of 4 women will have at least one. Symptoms are usually intense itching, thick white discharge, and sometimes burning. But don't self-diagnose repeatedly. Get properly tested, especially if treatments aren't working.
What about bacterial vaginosis? This seems less familiar to most people.
PV is actually more common than yeast infections, but less well known. It's an overgrowth of certain bacteria that causes a fishy odor and thin, grayish discharge. It's not an STI, but it does need antibiotic treatment.
You emphasize throughout the book that diagnosis matters more than self-treatment. Why?
Because symptoms overlap. What feels like a yeast infection might be BV, or a reaction to a new soap, or an STI. Using the wrong treatment can make things worse or mask a more serious condition. Plus, recurring symptoms might indicate an underlying issue that needs different management.
How should someone prepare for a gynecological appointment to get the most out of it?
Track your symptoms. When they started, what makes them better or worse, how they relate to your cycle. Write down questions beforehand because you might forget in the moment. Don't douche or use special products before your appointment. Your provider needs to see what's actually happening.
You have practical advice about advocating for yourself in medical settings. This seems crucial but challenging.
If a provider dismisses your concerns or says everything is normal when you know something is wrong, it's okay to push back. Ask specific questions. What else could cause these symptoms? Can we test for other conditions? Sometimes you need to see someone else.
Let's talk implementation. If someone reads this book, what should they actually do first?
Start with the mirror exercise. Seriously, you can't advocate for your body if you don't know what it normally looks and feels like. This isn't weird or inappropriate. It's basic self-knowledge.
What about tracking cycles and symptoms? What's the most practical approach?
Use whatever method you'll actually stick with. A phone app, a calendar, a notebook. Track your period, but also note discharge changes, mood, energy, pain levels. After a few months, you'll start seeing your personal patterns.
How long does it typically take to establish what's normal for someone?
At least 3 cycles, ideally 6. Your body isn't a machine. There will be variation month to month, but over time, you'll recognize your patterns and notice when something genuinely changes.
What's the biggest mistake you see people make when trying to apply this information?
Becoming hypervigilant and worrying about every small change. The goal isn't to obsess over your body, it's to develop comfortable familiarity. Most changes are normal variations, not signs of problems.
How should someone approach conversations with partners about this information?
Share what you're learning. Explain that discharge is normal, that lubrication varies, that your needs might change throughout your cycle. Good partners want to understand your body better, not remain ignorant about it.
What about talking to daughters or younger women in your life?
Start early with age-appropriate information. Normalize talking about bodies and periods. Give them a hand mirror and explain anatomy before problems arise. Make it clear that questions are always welcome and nothing is too embarrassing to discuss.
If someone only does one thing after hearing about this book, what should it be?
Stop using products marketed to make your vulva or vagina smell or taste different. Your body has its own natural, healthy scent. Embrace that instead of fighting it with products that can cause more problems than they solve.
What about the hygiene practices? What's the single most important change?
Switch to gentle, unscented soap for washing the vulva and never put soap inside the vagina. That one change prevents a huge number of irritations and infections.
Someone dealing with recurring issues like frequent yeast infections, what's the key takeaway?
Get properly tested each time instead of assuming you know what it is. Recurring symptoms often have underlying causes. Maybe it's not actually yeast, or there's a trigger you haven't identified. Don't keep throwing the same treatment at what might be different problems.
Let's evaluate this book critically. What does it do exceptionally well?
Normalizes conversations about female anatomy and makes medical information accessible without dumbing it down. The tone is reassuring but scientifically accurate. It fills a genuine gap in health education.
Where do you think the book has limitations?
It's focused primarily on cisgender women's experiences. While we touch on variations, we don't deeply address transgender or intersex experiences. The healthcare system advice is also somewhat generalized. Navigating medical care varies enormously by location and insurance.
How does this compare to other books in women's health?
Most are either too clinical or too alternative medicine focused. We tried to find a middle ground, evidence-based but practical, comprehensive but readable. Our Bodies Ourselves is more comprehensive but less current. Many newer books focus on specific conditions rather than general health literacy.
What important topics does the book not cover that readers might need to seek elsewhere?
Pregnancy and childbirth, menopause, contraception methods, and detailed STI prevention. We also don't go deep into pelvic floor disorders or complex conditions like endometriosis. These each deserve their own focused resources.
The book became quite controversial in some circles. What criticism did you receive?
Some religious conservatives objected to frank discussions of sexuality. Others felt we were too Western-focused in our approach to healthcare access. A few medical professionals initially dismissed it as oversimplified, though most came around once they saw how it helped patients ask better questions.
How do you respond to critics who say this information should come from doctors, not books?
Ideally, yes. But the reality is that many doctors don't have time for comprehensive education during brief appointments, and many weren't taught this information well themselves. Books like ours are meant to supplement medical care, not replace it.
Since publication, how has the conversation around women's health evolved?
There's definitely more openness. Period poverty is getting attention. More research is being funded on conditions like endometriosis. Social media has created communities where people share experiences, though that comes with misinformation risks too.
What changes do you still want to see in healthcare and education?
Better sex education that includes anatomy, not just pregnancy prevention. More research funding for women's health conditions. Training healthcare providers to have these conversations comfortably and without judgment.
Has anything in the book become outdated since 2018?
The basic anatomy and physiology remains the same, obviously. Some of the research on the microbiome has advanced. There's more awareness now of how hormonal birth control affects some people's experiences, which we touched on but could explore more deeply.
What impact do you hope this book continues to have?
I want people to feel comfortable in their own bodies and confident asking questions. If someone reads this and then has a better conversation with their healthcare provider or stops feeling ashamed of normal bodily functions, that's success.
As we wrap up, what's the most important mindset shift you hope listeners take from our conversation?
Your body is not a mystery that needs to be solved by others. It's yours to understand, and you have every right to knowledge about how it works. Curiosity about your own anatomy isn't weird or inappropriate. It's smart.
Nina, thank you for this conversation and for writing such an important book.
Thank you for having me. I hope this helps people feel more confident and informed about their bodies.